to the Track and Food Podcast. You're joining us on another lovely fall day today. I'm your host, as
windy,
always.
Windy fall day.
A very windy fall day. I'm your host, as always, Jamie Maha. Thank you for joining us again. That voice right there you hear is my lovely co-host, Mickey McLeod. How are you today, Mickey?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm on short sleep. I was out last night
at
the Commodore. I went and saw a show with a friend. And
Jamie's living la vida loca before he turns 40, getting it all out of his system.
I am. So I was up pretty late. I have my sister staying with me right now, and she definitely gave me an eye roll when I...
What's your sister's name?
My sister's name is Jennifer.
What's up, Jennifer?
Yeah, and she
listening?
Definitely gave me an eye roll when I walked in the door this morning.
Good for her.
Yeah,
she's trying to look after her baby brother.
She's like, what's going on? Why are you coming in so late? But no, things are good, and how are you?
I'm good. Yeah. Again, you asked me, you're super rusty, man.
Yeah,
that's like the second
rusty,
episode in a row.
Yeah. Yeah.
That you've double asked me how I'm doing.
I
appreciate
it.
You're trying to involve me more in the show.
I
really
elaborate.
Respect that.
Well, this morning you were like, you were giving me some gears. You're like, should I host? Because I was a little bit.
Yeah. Because I've already been up and to the gym, and now I'm drinking a delicious glass of scotch.
Yes, we are drinking some pretty good scotch today. So, but as always, thanks again for joining us. If you're a first time listener, we are kind of a food and culture podcast based in Vancouver. Our latest episode, we just had James Irons add on from Gooseneck Hospitality.
What's up, James?
Do check that episode out. You can always find us on Apple Podcasts, Luminary, and Spotify.
And if you're listening, James, which I know you are, Bells and Whistles was fantastic. I got 56 on the Papa Shot basketball game.
Yeah, he gave us all these free coins. And we went off. I only got.
Thanks for taking care of us. Really appreciate it.
What did I get?
It's good to see you, Josh.
I got 34.
And I will be back. You got 34, but I got 56, which was the record of the day that day.
Yeah.
No, 58. I beat 56.
58, yeah.
But I think 96, like he said, is impossible. So we'll see. I'll have to go back and dig in and
we had some good beer
get
there,
some more coins. We did, yeah.
You had a Goza, didn't you?
I had a Goza, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
It's funky.
So you have to explain that beer to me all the time. I always forget what it is.
Yeah, I'll tell you about it later.
Yeah. Anyways, we're very excited to have... very esteemed guest today. I feel very endowed today because we're bringing on someone who's pretty. This is a pretty big fish, and we're bringing on the editor, food editor of VanMag. His name is Neil McLennan.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure a lot of people out there who've read his work, seen his work, probably been to the awards that they do. He's been in charge. How long have you been at VanMag?
Oh, I don't know, 12 or 13 years.
12 or 13.
Probably between Western Living and VanMag. They're both owned by the same company, so I've done both for. Probably more than a decade for sure.
Yeah. So he's luckily joined us today. And
we really appreciate it.
We want to pick his brain, kind of get some thoughts on some things. And it's always nice to bring people like Neil on today because he knows the industry better than we do.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows it from a very unique perspective. And he gets to write about it all the time. And it's always nice to get people like that coming in because I think one of the things we try to engage with this podcast is just talking to people who understand Vancouver's community, understand Vancouver's kind of scene, what we do here, a lot of things that are popping up, things that are coming in, what we feel. And we're very excited to talk to you today.
Well, without agreeing with all those things, some of which are not right about the knowledge and so forth. Yeah, it's good to be
here. Well, you did bring us some lovely whiskey today, by the way. What are we drinking today?
We're drinking, we'll see when this drops, we're drinking Ardbeg. This is a very cool thing. I like Islay whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
Ardbeg is releasing a 19-year-old whiskey. It'll drop in Vancouver on the 2nd of November. 19 years old is their oldest age expression is 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's Gaelic. I think it's Tryvann.
Okay.
Traighban, but I think that's Tryvann. So 19-year-old Islay whiskey, the smoke's dulled a little bit. It has a real nice citrusy, pineapple-y, long finish. It's a nice whiskey.
No, thank you.
This is the nicest thing we've ever drank in our podcast.
I was going to say this when I came in, I thought, I won't be the best guest, but at least for a brief period, I can set the the best prize.
He emailed me yesterday. He's like, do you guys like scotch? I'm like, do we?
Yes. Well, so. It's funny. My mom... I know she's listening. Shout outs, Beth. She one loves VanMag, two loves scotch, but she's on the way more peaty, smokier side. So is that Islay as well?
That is Islay.
I wish I knew more about scotch. I'm more of like a bourbon.
The original
rye guy.
Yeah. I love that too. The Ardbeg is Rocklady and Ardbeg sort of corner the market on the really deep
peaty.
It would sort of be those guys, then sort of down to Lagavulin, then to Laphroaig, and then those are the
staples
real
that we always have at the hotel is those two, right?
So. Yeah, those are the heavy hitters. The Diageo ones are obviously front and center.
Yeah.
But the Bruichladdich Auchtermore is the real.
That's a big
too
one.
Much for me. The real smoke bomb, but nice whiskey.
Yeah.
Real nice whiskey.
Are you a big whiskey guy?
I'm a big whiskey.
Yeah,
I don't drink it that often. Yeah. I just don't drink hard liquor as much as I used to.
Yeah.
But one of the benefits of that is I legitimately do have an amazing whiskey collection. I might have 100 or 120 bottles.
Are you serious?
Wow. Malt, yeah.
Oh, wow.
But only because I just don't drink it as much as I used to. If I was back in the day, they wouldn't have lasted. But now I drink it once in a while after dinner, sometimes before dinner. But I collect them. If I'm out and if I'm a duty free or if I'm in some place, that's almost always the thing I'm looking for. Even more than wine, I'll bring a bottle of whiskey back.
Wow. Is it always Scottish whiskey?
No. I have a pretty good collection. I love Irish whiskey. I love rye. I love American rye. I like Canadian whiskey. Pretty thin on bourbon, to be honest. Bourbon is for me, just the opposite of that. Don't love it.
Mm.
Pretty small on Japanese whiskey. Although every time when people know you like whiskey and you have a party, everyone brings Japanese whiskey.
Yeah, it's the thing right now. Hibiki, Nika, all that stuff. Yeah, so it's good. I don't know. I love whiskey. It's something I will always drink.
Yeah.
I never think to order it. I always find that interesting. I never go to a bar.
In Vancouver, you have to sort of go to other places in not only the country, but also, sorry, not only our country, but you have to go across the border to really get, if you go to Portland, to the whiskey library, you see shit that there that
Multnomah?
Multnomah. That's one of the great bars in the world. It's just amazing bar.
We don't seem to get the really good stuff or the really high age stuff.
You know what we are getting now, this doesn't affect me or 99% of the people, because of our large offshore, very wealthy demographic that's coming here. We're actually one of the world's top markets for unbelievably expensive. Right. There was a 62-year-old Macallan, 62, maybe 72, they entered a lottery for. I went to some dinner. It was at 39th and Cambia. I can't remember what it was. It was $65,000 or $75,000. And there was a brief period where I thought, I just needed a backer. I was going to buy it because you could immediately resell that. There's so few bottles there that it's just a commodity. It's not a bottle of whiskey anymore.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I did legitimately think I should put my name in and buy it, but then I just couldn't pull the trigger. I freaked out at the thought of it. But even knowing that you could, in theory, sell it to someone else in the room, potentially for $25,000, it would be illegal, of course, to resell whiskey.
Because no one does.
Because our liquor laws are absolutely there for our protection and completely sane and logical. But I did think about that. But we get those super high end ones.
Yeah.
And, I have a lot of trouble with the liquor board a lot, not from a consumer's side, but I will say in the whiskey, they've been moving in a good direction. Okay. The whiskey releases on the second, so that's when this Ardbeg will come out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's getting better and better.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
It's getting better and better. And they're branching out. They're getting some decent Irish whiskey for now. They have a couple they used to never see Greenspot. I remember the first time I saw Greenspot, it was like, wow, it used to be a unicorn whiskey. Now granted, they're cranking out a lot more of it, but now they have some of the cooler expressions of that. So they're doing a better job.
Okay.
It's not Alberta. You'd still go to Alberta.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The Costco. I was at Costco
airport,
the other day, and they had like a 4-liter bottle of Johnnie Walker Blue Label. It's not really my whiskey, but it's still sort of a wow whiskey. It's not, and I think it was like $230. It was a monster bottle of Johnnie Walker Blue. And I just thought there was something about that. It was sort of grotesque, but in a good way. Like,
for $230?
I think it's $230 or $260. Like, it was unbelievable. It was almost the same price as a $750.
Oh my god.
It must have been a 1.75. It wouldn't have been a Texas Mickey, but 1.75 are almost what the cost of the bottle is here.
Yeah. Johnnie Blue is like, I always say it's kind of like a little secret thing for me. I'm like, I kind of love Johnnie Blue. I don't know why.
It's good.
It's just overpriced. I would never pay that price for it. But if it was it's like, because the difference between that and the Platinum is like massive. It's like, it's like, you're just paying for it's like paying for something like a high end Gucci bag or something. You're just paying for the status of it.
Do you guys know the Dumpling King, Matthew?
We met him at the Chefs in the Hood event last year.
He makes dumplings. They're expensive. He makes Johnnie Walker Black dumplings. Have you had them before? They are so good.
Really?
Oh, they are so, so good. I think they're like 50 for 50. So they're not cheap, but they shouldn't be cheap. That guy spends a lot of time and effort. I don't know him other than getting them. And I was going to, I have one party every year. Like, I don't socialize much.
Yeah.
But once a year, I have a party for Robbie Burns. And that's when all the whiskey comes out. A lot of people, like 200, 250 people. And this year I thought, you know what, I'm going to get the Johnnie Walker Black dumplings. But then I emailed him and said, how much are they? And he's like, 50 for 50. And I was like, oh yeah, that's too much. But I did still get some for myself. But
But you were contemplating paying $25,000 for a bottle.
Yeah, exactly. That was gonna make, that was a money making.
I know. Maybe you said that. Maybe you said that. I was just like, wow. I was like, oh,
but yeah. But I don't know him at all other than buying the things. But the Johnny Walker Black Dumplings,
yeah,
for dumpling, are out of this world. Good.
You throw a party a year, every year, for 250 people.
Yeah, I do. I feel like I get all my.
Where do you throw that?
At my house.
Oh my God.
It's a good party. It's a pretty good party. I hire a bagpiper so everyone gets piped into the house. And people, it's always on a Sunday, and people like Robbie Burns. They like the idea of it, and it sort of gives you a carte blanche to get a little goofy. And there's always, it's mostly like when I say 250, it's like kids come and parents of friends come. So there's 68 year olds and there's 2 year olds. Those numbers seem, it's not like 250 adults.
Yeah.
But it's good.
Is it a summer party?
No, it's Robbie Burns is January.
Is it January? Oh, yeah.
It's a good time to throw a party.
Dumb question on my part.
Yeah.
Can we get invited?
Well, we'll see. We'll see how the rest of this goes. Before the hard questions start coming, we'll see. But yeah. It's a good party, and it is. There's always a dozen or two people who hit the whiskey super hard. So the whiskey's just all on one big table, and most of it, like this, I would probably have in maybe a slightly different
smaller
thing.
Room.
That's a terrible host thing to say, but I wouldn't have the really pricey stuff out. That's always down somewhere where we can do it. But there's always, there's always a handful of people who on a Sunday night leave at one after having consumed it.
We've
three quarters of a bottle of scotch.
Yeah.
We had a party here last year in June or whatever it was?
Yeah.
And we had one guest who came first. And he also was last.
Yes.
And he was like at one point.
The bookender.
He was just sitting there and we were like, it was like, must have been like 6 a.m. and me and Mickey were like, with another friend, we were chatting basketball stuff. And then we just kind of looked over and then he was just kind of like teetering. And we're like, oh, we got to get someone out.
I got a lot of noise complaints. For people listening, our recording studio is actually in my apartment in the living room. We sit on cork cushions. It's very zen. A lot of wood in here. But I got about 7 noise complaints that. But I'm the same as you.
Yeah.
I do one a year,
maybe
two. But it's always really fun to have people over. But that's my max. I'm only good with so much social interaction per day. And then I fill up, which is where I'm a bartender.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you get it done. You get it.
Get it done.
The claim to fame, it just sounds like a bad claim to fame. 2 years ago, someone shot. It wasn't a party goer. But what? Right in front of the house. A high-speed chase ended with some Albertan who had run a stop check. And no kidding, they shot the guy in the car.
Oh, my God.
Whoa. He didn't die, but there was a couple partygoers who just came in and said, hey, someone just got shot, like right near the front lawn. I was like, yeah, good one. It is a good party, isn't it? I'm like, no, somebody just got shot.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Anyway.
Oh, my God.
That's not what you want.
No, that's
okay. Hopefully that doesn't
much.
Happen again.
And by the way, that's a high bar for raising hell in subsequent years.
That's true.
On that note, oh my God, that's kind of crazy. Anyways, yeah, this whiskey is pretty awesome.
Well,
but,
you're on, yes, so we will be invited next one. We'll talk about that after.
Yes.
Should I give him the hard questions? I want to get invited to this.
Are there any hard questions on the show? I don't know.
I have a few.
All right, well, let's get to it.
So you've been a van, you were saying right there earlier, you've been a van mag for about 12 years.
Yeah.
Was that something, is in the 12 years, I mean, this is the first question that popped in my head when I wanted to talk to you. Because like I met Neil about 3 years ago. I right when I started kind of getting into journalism, I reached out to him and I was like really kind of just an eager beaver. And I just wanted to speak to someone who was in the industry and kind of like give some insight. And Neil was very, very nice and outgoing and was open to saying, you know, I'd love to come in and give you some tips and talk to you and kind of give you some insight. So I definitely want to say thank you for that. And you've been someone I've always kind of like admired, and I respect the work that you do, but you've been doing it for 12 years. You've definitely seen the decline in journalism.
Oh, absolutely.
And,
absolutely. Yeah.
As someone who's definitely working this field for that long, how do you struggle with the notion that people just don't, it's just a dying industry, but it's dying in a sense that it's evolving because podcasting is something that's part of it now, but especially print is gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Old school print. I mean, it's tough. I mean, the short answer is it's tough, right? I mean, a good year is maintenance. And that's just not the way an industry should be. But you're right. It is going in different directions. We aren't as much going in a different direction. That's sometimes tough. I mean, the classic sort of heritage media brands have a very difficult time pivoting like that. The Times has done it a little bit, but that's very few. Like most of them haven't done it. And I remember when you and I were having a discussion about getting into it, it's an interesting thing because I don't want to be discouraging because I do think it's a rewarding and interesting thing to do. I don't think I said start a podcast, but if I was thinking, I would have. Like, that's the proper creative outlet for someone now to be doing. Like, a print magazine, certain print magazines, as between the two magazines, Western Living is broadly better positioned because it's something you want to have in your hands. People want to look at houses and design and so forth. Van Magazine are probably a more difficult position just because, you know, I wrote a review, whatever, months ago, and it's not out yet. And in that interim, there might be 8 dozen things that have happened to that restaurant or whatever the trend is and so forth. So that the timelines connected to print and turnaround are just brutal. They're brutal for the way I don't consume news that way.
Yeah.
I want
it immediately.
Absolutely, yeah.
So it changes our focus a little bit, and at least with respect to food, but also with politics. It's not my area, but with politics, it's super tricky, right? Yeah. People are immediately live tweeting from whatever the council meeting that's important on development. And we're writing a story on it. So you have to do a broader, the goal is to try and do a broader stuff. But yeah, it's declining. Is it bottoming out and maintaining a bit? Tough to say, but it's tough.
Do you guys ever have conversations about something other than that where like you guys would ever phase out the magazine and just do it online?
Yeah, I mean, there's a discussion about it. I mean, I don't say there's a discussion about it. There's been discussions about making things go online. You know, our new parent company is Canada-wide. I say new, it's a year or two. But they did that with BC Living. They started out as a print mag, and they said, "You know what? It's not clicking the way we want it." And they morphed it into an online thing. They then have morphed it up even more again into a sort of a subscription boxy type model, and that's been very successful. So there are discussions about that. I mean, if you just ever went straight online, though, it's very difficult to make money. I mean, the people won't pay for online ads the way they'll pay for print ads. That just is a hard truth. So you'd have to reconfigure a whole bunch of things. But I'm sure people in that part of the company are thinking about it frequently or figuring out angles they could play.
Because of that, does that ever cause you to have to change the way you focus your work? Because you have to kind of gravitate and try to catch the reader in a different way?
Yeah, sure. I think it's more on, you know, like we do a couple big, more food-related stories a year. So outside of the food thing. And last year it was, I know I was listening to your guys' podcast with Max. And the last one we did that was longer and bigger was on open outcry. And I just met with Sean and with Glassford and Walker, with Aaron and Phoebe. And that was a long story. We've been talking about that story for a bit about branding and the importance of it and how that all comes together. And that one was, that was a story that'd be very difficult to do online. It had spreads with mood boards and inspiration and all those things. And Craig Stangetta was doing the design. So all those things came together. And I think we had a lot of pages, 9 or 10 pages, which is a lot these days. And that's a story that works well in print. And it wouldn't work as well online. Somebody could figure out a way to do it interactively online, but you wouldn't normally see it like that. And so that's what we have to do. We have to gravitate to stories like that that have a longer, I mean, that lead time on that one's brutal, right? Like, I think it may say it's opening in
June.
I think the story says it came out in May, and I think it says it's opening in June, and they had every intention to open in June.
Yeah.
It's September.
Always push back.
They might make October. I think, let's hope for October.
Are they open right now?
Well, Max, no, they're not open yet. Max said that I think they're leaning towards like mid-September, but I think, that's obviously come and gone. Yeah. I think they're like leaning, I think they're close though. Yeah. I think they're like in the next like 2 weeks or so.
Yeah, even Como was backed up, I believe, two months. Yeah, yeah. I think when we had Sean on.
Yeah.
So,
and that's just the norm, right?
Yeah, I mean,
and that's not even new. I remember at Western Living, we reported we had our Foodies of the Year, Hawksworth, when he just had come back and was opening his place. I mean, that was like a year and a half late. I think it was like full calendar year, and it still had not opened after we said like opening. Anyways, that's the price we pay for the lead times we have. But that's the type of story that I would gravitate toward, the open outcry, a broader story, less newsy, right? Newsy is just going to be always difficult for us because in terms of print online, in theory, we can do whatever anyone else does. And we try and do that a little bit. But in terms of the print stories, you got to just go on a broader trendish story as opposed to trendy, like broad swaths of what's interesting and what's going on.
I love the work that you guys do on there. I think it's really cool. I love, like, especially I love when you do the wine once over. I think that's really fun. Yeah.
People don't love that. People get upset about that. People don't
like this one.
So he does a wine once over where he basically just goes to a restaurant and just kind of like just checks out the wine list.
And there's a lot of that criticism we would get. I say we, I mean me, is one of the things that's important for me on the journalism side, on the writing side, is to, and it's becoming more and more difficult, is to be of service to the consumer. That's the only goal we really have. Mm-hmm. On the food side, to be of service to the consumer. Someone's picking up the magazine, giving them legitimately what our honest thoughts are and honest advice. And for me, price is such an important factor. And for most reviewers and most of anything, they talk as if price is completely elastic, that it doesn't matter what the price is. They talk about the food, they talk about that. But, you know, when I think about when I go out with my family, when I go out with my friends, that's a concern. It's a concern for most people. I don't mean it's the only thing, but I don't want to go to a restaurant, find out the entrees are $45 mm-hmm. and having, of course, they're supposed to be good. Of course, the review is going to be good. And I do that with wine prices. One of the reasons is because you can just calculate how much the markup is.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, there are not very many restaurants in town. It's a good canary in a coal mine. It's not many places that mark their wine up more than three times that I want to patronize. For if that's what they do with the wine, I don't trust them with the food for the most part. There's a bunch of exceptions. Yeah. And, you know, a couple of times I said things that were probably too much. And once I can't remember who the nice guy, David, I can't remember, he's the sommelier at Shangri-La. And I called him out for a long time ago, it was called a Joao meter. And it just went through the prices of Joao Rosé when it was super popular at all the restaurants.
Yeah.
And the top was the Shangri-La. And at that time, it was at $66 or $67.
Per glass?
Yeah. No. For a bottle.
Oh, for a bottle.
For a bottle. Because that's a $20 bottle of wine.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah. And I called them out and they were at the top and said, you know, it sort of says what the sommelier thinks about you. And he was not happy. And I think what his point was, and he was fair enough, was like, I work at a big, expensive, super expensive hotel. I don't get to decide what my markup is. Don't tell me that that's what I think of my consumer. And that was fair enough. He had a point. The preamble that said that's what the psalm thinks about you was probably wrong and unfair. But I do think it's important to say, listen, if you're charging 3.7%, there's a real problem. So I do like the broad idea of talking about food costs and so forth. And one of the people, one of the reviewers who I know, I suppose she's controversial, but I have a good relationship with Alex Gill. And her and I used to argue about that a lot. I tell you, you got to put dollars and cents in your reviews. Like, you are very honest and you make a lot of enemies because if you're honest, but you got to tell people what the value is, what the cost is and what the value is.
Mm.
And I think, I don't know if she agrees with that. I see that she does it more. So I think there was at least some point taken there that's when the ordinary consumer picks up the magazine, that's a really important factor as to where you're going to go. So
It's interesting that you bring that up, because I'm actually just finishing up detailing a column that I wrote. I sent this to you about a year ago. I wrote it on diner misperception and pricing in restaurants.
Yes.
And I submitted to Andrew, and Andrew's like, I'll totally publish this. And so I just needed to get a little bit more Vancouver detail.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a couple of restaurateurs. I got Gino from Taco Pino. Yeah. They gave me some good insights. And I got Ron from Mammy's, and I got Tristan, who we're going to meet this week, who's running, who's a good friend of ours.
They're there.
Annalena's
new project. Yeah.
So they're just giving me some insight onto like what it is for them when it comes to pricing in restaurants and like people's perceptions and lag time and stuff like this.
Yeah.
And when you talk about that, I 100% agree with you, because giving people the perception of what something costs, it gives them an idea of what they're framing, and it gives them an idea of what they're buying, what they're going for, and an understanding of what you're talking about, especially. And I think I don't think you should be criticized that at all. I think it's a very noble thing to give people, like, okay, you're going to go to this restaurant and it's going to cost you $45 for that, whatever, what you're going to buy, that steak or whatever. And then you can give them a frame of reference of why you're saying yes or no, yes, you should get it, or no, you shouldn't get it. And I've always struggled with restaurant reviews, because I think sometimes I always think my opinion, who the hell am I?
Mm-hmm.
But then I also understand that people sometimes gravitate towards that. You know, whenever you go to a city, you and I are going to LA in a couple of weeks. You know, it's like,
we're obviously going to read reviews.
I'm going to go on Eater and I'm going to look at stuff and I'm going to
from list. A source that we trust, like a friend who's been there before whatnot. Yeah. Right.
But I understand them and I get them. I just, maybe just personally, I just don't know how to write them. And I just feel like if I wrote them, I would just be too prickish. Yeah. But
you are kind of,
you'd be surprised. Like, you think you are. Cause I would say most people say I'm a curmudgeon and a little bit of a crank, but it's hard to write a mean review. It's hard to press either publish or send it off. It's hard. Those are people's livelihoods, right? Yeah. It actually is. People think it's easy. It's not. You feel like a jerk doing it. And sometimes, but ultimately the, and I don't, I hardly ever do it. Like,
have
I
you ever written a scathing review? Have you, did you write one recently?
I wrote one recently. And that was, but that was like, that was, I honestly feel like that was warranted. There was a couple of things that I've made, might've changed on it. Like the title, it was a review of.
You're not the only one to say this, by the way.
Hydra, I've talked, right?
Yeah. Thank you for saying Hydra because I was going to pause and say.
Hydra.
It's Hydra.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that bugs me. I suppose that's the Greek pronunciation.
That's what they want you to say.
I said it wrong.
Hydra.
Okay.
They want you to say Hydra.
You and everyone else. You and legitimately everyone else.
Yeah.
Like, I grew up watching Hercules, a cartoon, and that was the Hydra. Like, that was like when Herc was fighting the whatever.
Yeah, it's the Hydra in Battle of Olympus, a Super Nintendo game.
We've all been wrong.
Yeah.
We've all been wrong.
How do you remember that?
Just from my youth, like Greek mythology is a huge influence on a lot of video games. But
so yeah, that was a very negative review. And one thing I might have changed, so I put that online, even though it was for the magazine, I put it online because I'd written it in June and it still wasn't out yet. And it was like the end of August. And I was concerned that someone else was going to review it before, like Alex. I could see Alex really putting the boots to it. And I thought, like, if ours comes out after, even though it was written 65 days before, we're going to look bad. So I put it out. And as I was putting it out, I changed the title. The title in the magazine that I think is out now is, it's pronounced Hydra. That's not a bad title. But for some reason, you know, you, especially when you're in the traditional media, you get on the computer and it's all fast and loose and seems easy. So I changed it to Hydra is a dumpster fire of a restaurant, which I believe.
Wow.
But that was a strong.
I've heard a lot of people. No, when I read it, I was like, oh shit. You're not off. I've heard a lot of people say the same thing.
By the way, it's expensive.
I've heard a lot of people.
Three times markup on a lot of the wine.
I've heard a lot of
pork chops. The lamb chops I had, which were the worst I've ever had, maybe anywhere. I think they were $44 or something. Mm. So it's not cheap.
Mm.
It's pretty. But that one, I felt like there was an obligation. And the funny thing is, journalism, like, I don't know what to say about that. No one says anything negative anymore. And people are shocked when they read a negative review.
Yeah.
But when we sit together and chat, like,
we'll bitch
all the time about things. And the thing that drives me crazy is we live in this, in the food writing portion, but maybe in all of it, we live in this hypocrisy where no one ever says anything. So you wouldn't think if you had typed in Hydra, so let's agree with the premise, at least in my world, everyone was talking about how bad Hydra was. Mm. Like, I talked to our restaurant judges. We have 20 of them, more than 20. I have a lot of faith in their palate. And a ton of them were saying, oh God, it's just brutal. It's not bad. And the other thing is that, if you typed in Hydra into Google, all you would get is these positive things about people who went to a media event and say how great it is. So you, I'm exactly like you guys. If I go to another town, I would Google Eater. And I always think, when we talk about the restaurant awards, I always think, well, someone's coming in from New York and they want to know where to eat. And if they Google Van Meg, that's one of the things the restaurant awards is as important for. And that's the person I sometimes think of, in some ways, a little bit more than the Vancouverite, I think, because it serves both when you think that way, is what are they going to think if they Google Hydra? Are they going to think this place is great? Because that's all you would think.
Yeah.
There's one sort of quasi review from Mia Stainsby that was relatively positive, but that was a review. I mean, it's a great, great person. But other than that, there was a zillion stories, I put in quotes, about how great it was, about people who went there with the PR thing.
Mm-hmm.
And surprise, surprise, you know, when you go with a PR person, you get really good service.
Yeah,
you get the best cut.
Yeah.
I mean, and how is that serving anybody? It just drives me nuts that that's become our norm, our accepted norm of how we report on things. Nothing would be better.
Yeah.
Like, but a misleading thing based on a sort of co-opting of what a writer should be doing is, so that's, I mean, when you ask, I think I said that to you when we chatted, Jamie, all those, that was 3 years ago and it's 10 times worse now. That's where it's going. And that's why you have to break the looms and do this. Legitimately, that's why you have to do it.
Do you feel like the Alex Gills of the world are very important then?
I do. Yeah. I do. Like, I mean, people, Alex has a lot of, I won't say she has a lot of enemies, but people, she ruffles a lot of feathers.
Oh, when she comes in to the restaurants and stuff like this, people get up, tussle up.
And by the way, that's not easy. I mean, I don't know. I Alex is just a person. Like, that can't be easy. Like, I have a wine event I'm supposed to go to in 3 weeks. I just got to, and I can't, oh, it's, it's a Barolo producer, so I really want to go. It's a lunch, but I was like, I saw it was at Hydra. I'm going to feel like a total jackass if I go in there.
Yeah.
I also really want to drink the Barolo, so it's a real, I want to say it's a real Sophie's choice. That is not the proper use of the word.
That's
Sophie's
not,
choice,
yes.
But it is a tough choice. People start saying Sophie's choice instead of tough choice. And they're sort of different, you know. But anyways, I don't know if I'll go or not.
Did you get any flack from them?
Oh, yeah.
Did you?
They bought an ad in the magazine saying, I'm a hack and don't know what I'm talking about. A full-page ad.
Wow.
And then the print magazine.
Wow.
And they wrote an email right off the bat, like off the handle, upset.
Did they ask you to come back? No?
Like I don't know if I would be. The tone of was such that I would be slightly nervous.
Yeah. Okay. So I just want to say that I know, I used to work for Claire and Mark. So I know them.
Yeah.
You want to, Claire and Mark who? From
Claire Wright and Mark Greenfield. Who opened Hydra. Sorry.
Yeah.
I believe that's them that opened it. Hydra.
They own it or they run it?
I'm
the
not sure.
The executive hotel, I think, owns it, but I'm not 100% sure.
Okay. So I know that they both come from this line of Global Group. And
yes.
I know that EMAD, like I worked for them for 2 years and some of the shit EMAD would.
Yeah, yeah.
Would try to get away with is fucking legendary, like serving Kobe beef and not having it be Kobe beef.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what you were saying about this whole hype and like the positive reviews to try to get people come in is a real thing that EMAD, like the culture of his restaurants was trying to do. It's like literally tell everyone you're the best.
Yeah.
And then.
So one of the things that, I really struggled with in that review is I didn't say I called up, but I made reference to the PR because it was a press release that said, unsurpassed or something, right? Like it had a bunch of superlatives that when I read it, I was like, oh God, that's really setting the bar high. Like, you really want to do that? They were legitimately suggesting that this was going to be the greatest restaurant to open ever. And the reason when I write something like that is not because I care or give a shit. Like you see things like that all the time. But that was the talk amongst all the food writers. Did you see that press release? Oh my God. Who would say, like, they're really pushing it? And I have no doubt. I have no doubt it was the PR, not the PR people, I know the PR team. It's not at all like anything else they do. They never go overboard like that. They're never puffery like that. So I have no doubt it was the owner saying, listen, we want this to make a huge splash.
Mm-hmm.
But I put that in the review that the press release was et cetera, et cetera. And I know that Ruff says, but I honestly did think that was important because that's part of the whole continuum now in the food industry, right? We talk about chefs and servers and bartenders about, you know, they're the stars and that we talk about them as such, but we never talk about the unbelievably important people. Like how many guys do you know in the industry or women in the industry who have opened a restaurant thinking, you know, we know what we're doing and you have a lot of respect for them one way or the other. And for some reason, the restaurant just fizzles because they don't have money to hire PR and it's just murder. Like how many restaurants have been able to do it alone? The only one I can think of is Como.
Did not Sean have any PR.
That's
Sean
a very small sample size, though.
That is two guys who are perhaps two of the most beloved people on all, like people in the industry, people on my side of the thing. A small space. They know everybody, right? But that's the exception. That's not how it works.
And they have so much experience. And like Sean had like such a good name going into it. Like, people are like, I love Sean Layton. We're totally going to support this.
Yeah.
And then they did their research. They did their work. You know that they've really put a lot of thought into it. They came into a really good idea and then they knocked it out of the park.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's been great.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you're right. Like
that's the exception.
Yeah.
You try and open without proper PR support in this city and you got a death wish.
Do you ever see that now? Because you come from that perspective that you're like, oh my God, I can't believe people still open restaurants in the city.
Oh boy. Well, when you're just talking about James going for, I guess, James and Josh going for 6 and 7 restaurants.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, like when you just think about the number of people that you employ and the thing is, the reason you get into the business, I assume, is not to be a HR manager. Like that's a hassle once you get big. And the food costs and the liquor costs and the liquor availability, you got to bash your head against the wall. I have no idea why people do it. Like I have all the respect for people who do it. And again, that's why I'm not interested in shitting on anyone for the sake of clicks or of doing that. Like that's the last thing I want to do. I have utmost respect. Now, this is not really a grassroots restaurant, Hydra. I'm not saying that factored into my review. It wasn't good, but I didn't lose sleep over somebody had mortgaged their entire family's future to open that place. And I would I have thought twice about it? I probably wouldn't have, but it might have entered into my thought process. I don't know.
I think it's good. I mean, like, I definitely don't know how to do them, but I definitely appreciate when someone's honest and says, hey, you know what?
Well, someone has to be keeping the field level by reporting, by speaking on the negative aspects. Because if someone's serving shitty product, the food quality is shitty. People need to know that, right? There's so many times I think people are, like you said, about these reviews and Yelp reviews and stuff like that. And there's such a gray area in terms of reviews. Like, I think to the Crab Park thing. What happened?
The chowder thing. Talk about that.
One Instagram post, and then completely changed the entire trajectory of that
of two
company.
Businesses.
So there's such a weird gray area with social media and how people report on stuff. So, but for respected journalists to be actually putting something in print or something on their professional site that's backed behind chef's palettes, and that's very important.
It is a throwback, though. I mean, it is becoming with each passing year less and less important. I mean, I have relationships with PR people, but I would think if you're doing a modern PR campaign, you would focus your efforts and money on influencers and Instagram, because they, for the most part, don't care. They'll do whatever you say.
I hate that word so much.
And it works. I think it works relatively. I don't know if it works in the long
term.
It does.
So we work for the Fairmont, right?
Yeah.
How grandiose and respected is that brand, Fairmont? Massive. Worldwide.
Yeah, Canadian legend,
3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago had a fucking social media influencer in our lounge at the airport. And it was people were like freaking out, oh my God, this has to be perfect. They're can you do a cocktail presentation? I'm like, what's going on? Who's this person? Oh, she has however million followers. I'm like, what? We're the fucking Fairmont. What's happening? And it clicked in my head that this is
it's
the
important.
World now.
It's important.
This is how people... make these decisions.
Absolutely.
It's crazy to me. Crazy.
It is what it is.
Do you guys notice that with your online presence when it comes to your Facebook page and your Instagram page and your Twitter page? Is that something that you have to put a lot more focus on?
You know, weirdly, we have a lot for an old media brand of Twitter followers, because our former editor, Gary Ross, was a really early adopter. I say a lot. I can't remember what it is, 80,000 or something or other. When we don't maintain it as much as we should. We're more on Instagram. But yeah, absolutely. That's a huge part of it. And, you know, I don't mind. So we go to media events. I go less and less to media events, but other editors will go. And, you know, I don't mind Instagram showing a picture of a new room. I just don't want a story that purports to be a review having gone to a media event. An Instagram picture of check out Doce's just opened on Kingsway. It's fine. That's information, right? And I do think there's Daily Hive is great on information. They have so much good information on food restaurants and openings and so forth. They're on top of everything, almost everything. And they don't pick and choose. They don't curate it. It's really just
just blast it out.
Yeah, it is. But it's on top of it. I go on it. Go on it. And half the time I'm like, well, geez, I didn't know that. I didn't know that was closing. They're completely valuable on it. But anything deeper than that, it's not for me. It doesn't work for me on any deep level. But on that level, and that's a pretty important level, they're knocking it out of the park.
Do you have whispers out there for you to help you find stuff? Or do you just have people come to you?
Not really. No? Not really. I have, I'm not particularly an industry guy. You know, when you guys go to parties, I don't generally don't do it, partly because it's a church and state thing. I feel, partly I have a... I'm older than most of the people in the industry. I have a family. At the end of the day, I want to go home and hang out with my wife and kids. Partly it's just because it's not never been my thing. I have people who I know. You said James was just on. I'm friendly with James. We don't go for beers or anything. But if we see each other, we'll have a good chat. And Robert Belcham would be a guy. A bunch of people who I respect and who are often in similar situations in life. But yeah, people will tell me things. Sean Layton, I've known since he was just starting out, and so I have a really good relationship with him. So when Como was coming along, he was doing that, and when Pepino's, that was a scoop, I guess, we had when Pepino's was opening, but we're not really in the scoop business.
Yeah, that was a good feature you guys did on them.
And that's another person who I have a lot of time for, just a lot of time for. You know, all those people. I mean, those are four or five that came to my head, but there's a lot of people like that who are just not in it for the flash and dash, who put in the hours, who grind it out. And I just think when you say, could you ever open a restaurant? I couldn't. But when you see someone who's good at it and mixes sort of passion with sweat and people skills. It's a pretty amazing thing for sure.
Yeah, I mean, like Mickey and I can talk about this. I mean, we've been working in the industry for years, but sometimes when I see someone opening up something, like when I was talking with James the other day, we were sitting there, and literally when he told me he was there opening up two other places, I was just like aghast. I was like, what?
Yeah.
I was like, well, how do you have the energy for this? How do you have the stamina for this? How do you have the patience for this? How, and like, they're opening up the new place in like next month.
Yeah.
And he was like calm as a fiddle. Yeah. I was just like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah.
How do you do it and make it seem so easy? Well, but look at him. Every place they've done is great. Yeah.
Trial and error, and he's way more confident now. But I feel like a lot of people, when the romantic idea of opening a place kind of overwhelms them, not realizing what you actually need to do to be successful.
Staffing right now, in the last couple of years in the city, like staffing.
Yeah.
That would be enough. Even once I looked at the staffing, I just say, forget it. Like, there's no way. How are we ever going to get people?
Well, think about it. I mean, that's one of the things you want to think about the industry is how it's changing so rapidly. You know, a lot of it's going to the service counter model because people just can't afford the staffing. You can't find a lot of chefs.
What places currently in our city are counter service? Or is it just sort of like something that's
hall.
Coming?
Is Brew Hall called Brew Hall still?
Yeah.
You know that one down in Olympic Village, the big brew pub?
Craft.
Yeah, I know. No, the one right on.
Yeah.
It used to be called Iron Steel Toad. Steel Toad. It's called Brew Hall.
Yeah. But
think about where Tristan works. I mean, he works at Hundy. Counter service.
Yeah.
I mean, think about that model, right? So they could have easily had that. I mean, we were there a couple weeks ago and it was packed. On a Friday night, it was packed. Mm-hmm. It was 10 o'clock, full. Everyone's having burgers. Everyone's having a good time. It's a great atmosphere in there.
Yeah, good wine list, good beer list.
Yeah, it's like great.
It's very Portland.
Yeah. They were doing a tap takeover.
30% more expensive than it would be at Portland, but we have different things.
Like, but when you go to Portland.
Bit pricey. I love finding it. Tiny bit pricey, but you know what? Sorry, Mickey. That goes, I feel like I've matured up past price. They use good ingredients, though, right?
They use
good ingredients, and that costs
a little bit.
Extra buck or two more, I think. They're not going to No Frills and buying chuck there, right? I think they probably have Two Rivers or something or other.
Yep.
And I've gotten past my sort of price. On something like that, I don't super focus on price because I actually do think, and those guys are pretty light PR too. I know who works them, but that whole group is pretty light on the PR. They just do good shit.
And it's great.
Mikey's from the Oakwood, right? And then Open Natalina, and then now this. I'm sure they're doing a couple other things, but the money's involved. Oakwood was like that. It was like super quality ingredients and they didn't boost. I think at one point when I was working for Global, Oakwood was the number one restaurant in Vancouver on Yelp.
Yeah.
For like, I think like a year straight. And they evolved from that. But
what?
Yeah. We were trying to, so we were like five. I've worked for that Global Group and Satay Bar.
Yeah.
And that was a big thing back then. This was in 2013, 2014. Yelp. Yelp. If you, there was like a ranking in Vancouver, right? You had, Blue Water was always up there. Global was always, we were at five and we just like kept slipping and slipping. I don't know, it's weird. I was running it and we kept slipping. So strange. I wasn't running it, but I was the manager. Oakwood would hold at one. Before Tristan was working.
Do people even look at those things?
I don't look at Yelp.
I
look at it because it's funny.
Yeah.
I would never, on any used to be. I would never look at
it. I've never gone to Yelp.
Yeah. Well, just in that company globally, it was like, that was the number one thing you looked at in the beginning of the day. Was like complaints and our Yelp ranking.
Hedra has a massive TripAdvisor. It says in their ad, they have a massive TripAdvisor, really good.
TripAdvisor, not Yelp. It could be either or.
601. Okay, I'm going to ask hard questions now. This is, talk about, I want to talk about Aperol spritzes. Because this goes into my thought of co-opting, of independent, of how journalists get co-opted, journalists go to Bosnia and South Sudan, writers.
Yeah.
I've been co-opted, all of us, but bartenders, so this summer, the story came out in the New York Times, the Aperol Spritz is not a good drink.
Mm-hmm. I read that.
By the way, it's a very well-written story. It had likewise, like the Hedra thing, the head of it, the title was a little bit more inflammatory than the story.
Right.
The writer, she said, you know, spritzes are great, but why would you use Aperol, et cetera, et cetera. I thought it was good. I actually don't think the Aperol spritz is a good drink either. But here's the thing that I want to get your guys' take on it, is the legion of bartenders who came out in defense of the Aperol spritz. The Aperol spritz is a thing because of, who owns Aperol? Pernod Ricard?
I think so,
yeah.
Yes.
Because that's been driven down our throat. There's no suggestion that the Aperol is a better Amaro for drinks than any other one. In fact, there's probably a dozen ones that you guys can name right now.
Odd Society makes one that's infinitely better.
Exactly. So the weird defense of the, I think Sean might have been one of the people, of the
Aperol
Spritz.
I know personally seven people who were like, it's a delicious drink.
Well, that to me seems to be, I don't know because I'm not in the inside, that to me seemed co-opting of the bartending community. Like, who comes into defense of Aperol? You can come to defense of whatever the customer wants, I'll gladly make it with a smile, which has its own level of bullshit too. I do like the days when if someone came in sort of vodka tonic, came into the wrong bar.
Yeah.
Like, I think there's something to be said about that.
But when people come up to you and they're like, can you make me whatever you want to make? I'm like, oh, fuck. Seriously? The fuck
that
do
makes
you
sense.
Want?
I've been making an odd amount of Aperol spritzes this summer.
Yeah.
I'm sure that article,
I think
the subsequent.
I actually think the reason why people love Aperol spritzes so much, they just look good.
Yeah,
people love that color.
They're not good.
No,
that's what I mean. It's not like the Aperol Spritz is a bad drink. It's two problems with it. Every time someone orders it, they have that look on their face like they've just discovered it. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, like that's. I just have that. They think they're ordering like the coolest drink.
I've
ever.
Seen that look before.
And so whatever. Let's pass that.
I still get that with old fashions.
Yeah.
Totally. Old fashioned. Or Manhattan's.
I'm like,
Madman, calm down, buddy. Madman ate
it. Everyone fucking knows it. You're not Don Draper 10 years
ago. And the second part with the Aperol, Rich, is that you could make it, a talented bartender could make it way better without Aperol. You could make a really interesting, refreshing, low alcohol spritz. And you could.
Chinar is way better.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And that's widely available too. Anyway, so I like that article, but the theme I want to discuss or want to have your take on is, do the big brands, the Diageos and the Pernod and the Remy's of the world, does that influence in bartenders in the same way PR companies influence
writers? Of course it does. It totally
absolutely.
Does. 100%. I mean, we can speak about that right now. I mean, the fact
Mas Clamato and this whole Caesar stuff.
The Diageo,
I think the Caesar's a terrible drink, personally. But
the Diageo World Class just finished yesterday. And our good friend Jeff Savage from Botanist.
What did he finish?
Came fourth.
Wow.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, yeah. That's
Congrats,
fourth
Jeff.
In the world.
Fourth in the world.
Ah, I was in like Glasgow. I was in Isla, maybe.
Yeah, he was in Isla.
He's a beast.
I think he was fourth. I think that's what it was.
He made the top eight.
I think he was fourth, but I think he was fourth, but I was like, it looked like at one point, he won one of the challenges, and I think he did really well in the speed round. He was one of the only bartenders. I think he was the only bartender who got all his flags up. So that means they liked his drinks. But I mean, you definitely have to look at
brand loyalty because
brand loyalty
they flew him out and they.
Yeah.
Right? Now, so now his personal brand as Jeff Savage.
Is Diageo.
Yeah. Well, look at from Royal Dinette, look at
Caitlin.
Yeah.
Caitlin, I mean, she's a rock star. Yeah. Worldwide rock star.
But I mean, you definitely hark on a topic that does make sense. It's like, I mean, these competitions and these brand awareness things and like, you know, the Bacardi stuff and the stuff with the Diageo and like all these big
Woodford
things. Yeah. You know, like it definitely, I understand why the companies do it. You can get bartenders on your side and get them excited about your cocktails and putting your products on their cocktail menus and getting, you know, it's like, I mean, bartenders, I think they definitely feel an allegiance afterwards.
Yeah.
Definitely. And it can, I'm not saying it's frustrating as someone, because I don't compete, so I don't care. I mean, and anybody who all goes out there and wins a competition and competes and does well and feels they have a loyalty to a brand, all the power to them. It's not my business. I don't really care. But I do understand it because it does compromise you in some ways.
Yeah.
But
it's also enhancing the culture of bartending.
Yeah, it definitely does that.
Which is beneficial to everybody.
But then what he's hearkening to is the idea is like, okay, so why is everyone coming to the defense of Aperol? Is it because they're coming to the defense because they love the drink, or they're just like, don't fuck around with bartending. Don't fuck around with our cocktails. And it's like, really? That's a cocktail that was probably created just to get people to, you know, it's like the idea when you watch commercials and they're like, you know, have a gin and tonic. It's like, you just want me to drink that.
Yeah,
exactly. You know? I agree 100% that it's not a good drink at all. It's just refreshing and it can be made like millions of times better with different higher quality spirits. But yeah, man, I think I haven't competed as well, but we obviously know a lot of the guys who have. And that brand loyalty is something that, like, for a lot of these guys, it's like life changing. Like, look at Kate, Grancini would be a great example. Who's the
Chris
Hens?
Yeah. Like some of both Chris, both, I don't know Chris or Jeff. Like, I don't know them personally.
Oh, they're right.
And, like, I'm not back in the day, I used to write the column, so I sort of broadly knew who the bartenders in town were, but now I've fallen out of that. So I still have like an outdated view of who the top guns are, but I hadn't heard of either of those two. And then they, bam, they win it, and bam, they're suddenly out there. And it really does it. That Diageo in particular elevates you in a hurry.
Oh, yeah.
Also, well, you probably can't, there's probably some sort of contract they have to sign where they can't slander any of the products.
I assume so, right? Yeah. I don't know the answer to that. What about the? I'm now I have one follow up question.
I like
so
this.
When we do when we decide the Bartender of the Year, the Van Mag Awards, they used to be decided by the alums. They would all do it. At one juncture, it wasn't me. It was former editor of Van Mag, John Burns, and he said, "We're bringing it back in house. The judges are going to do it." And I don't know. I actually don't know what John's reasoning was. I think one of the things was is they hadn't had a woman at all. And it wasn't just that sort of equal opportunity. Like we had some female bartenders who were like back in the day who are like knocking it out of the park, who are getting worldwide reputation, and they still couldn't win the Van Mag Bartender of the Year. I think Danny Tataro.
Danny Tataro.
But
just
that
thinking
was
of...
like 7 or 8 years in. Like that was deep into it
mm-hmm.
when the bartenders were doing it. And I think rightly or wrongly, there was a thought that that it was just whoever the next. The guy in the dude club was gets nominated by the previous 7 winners. So it got taken away. And then the last couple of years, last 2 years, I once I've in charge, I said, you know what? We now have a fantastic panel, diverse panel that's back. So Amber was the first winner on the way back who has been decided again by the bartenders. But the last year it was decided by the judges. Satoshi won.
Yeah, Satoshi won last year.
Which was super cool choice. I loved that. But there was a big debate. A lot of the judges said, competitions, that's not, we're going to ignore competitions as a criteria. That's not when, if this is a consumer magazine, you walk in there, who's going to be there making your drink? Because they weren't talking about Caitlin in particular, but you win the whole thing. You have responsibilities around the globe, right? You're not at the bar very often.
You're on the road.
You're on the road. I mean, any of the high-flying bartenders who have won things, you look at their Instagram feed and I mean, they're in like Cape Town and then they're in Melbourne and they're in
them.
Hong Kong.
I work with them. They're on the road a lot.
Grant, I don't say it in a bad way, but his Instagram account, that guy's got to get platinum status on Cathay Pacific.
I think he's getting close to 40 countries.
Yeah.
Really?
Travel to.
Anyway, so there was a thought process, at least between not all the judges, but a chunk of the judges that we don't care. We care about who's going to be there making drinks.
That makes sense.
And the culture and the attitude of the bar is going to be set by said bartender.
How does that work for you guys? Because that's a great segue for us to get into something because I definitely want to ask you questions about this. But like, how does that work for you guys when you guys feel the Van Mag Awards? You guys feel a certain responsibility to be super current and kind of like we need to make sure that we get this right, or is it something that's like,
you know, we get it wrong? Like, here's the cool thing about them is years ago. It might have been John Burns. It might have been Gary Ross. One of them made the decision to have accountants involved. So we don't direct them at all. Like we could go over last year's and there's one terrible mistake in my mind, like just a huge glaring omission. A couple other ones that are like real head scratchers. And if there's only 3 or 4 of those a year in whatever 35 or 36 categories, I'm fine with it. But you know, the judges go off, they're independent. I don't see the winners until they come back from the accountants. The judges send them to the accountants and I get them and there's always that, oh shit. Like, oh, there's always one or two that I, as I'm flipping through the spreadsheet from the accountants, are like, oh, how did that happen? And
do you ever want to say anything afterwards when you read that?
Oh yeah.
Or like, be like, we can't do this. We can't like.
Well, I do want to, but I can't. Like, I mean, we maintain that. Like, I mean, I think I guess I can be honest. Like, Chiappino's won best Italian restaurant in the city 2 years ago. And last year, it's not in the top 5. That's a problem. Like, that's just a problem. Nothing happened to that restaurant. Pino's still there. So one of those is right and one of those is wrong. Like, it can go from 1 to 4 and there can be reasons for it. But from 1, with everything steady as she goes at the ship broadly, like, it's not a restaurant that has wild swings. You could complain that it should have wild swings or it's not exciting enough, but it's as steady as she goes restaurant. So that one I looked at and I was like, no, there's nothing I can do.
I wrote about that actually. When I saw your awards, I wrote about that a year ago. I said, what do you do if you're a restaurant like St. Lawrence? You've won restaurant of the year for 2 years in a row.
Yeah.
And then the next year you come 4th, but you haven't done anything different.
Yeah,
you haven't done anything different. No one's, you're still the same restaurant. You're still just as good. you're just maybe just not the new kid on the block, but like, do you, how do you reckon with that as restaurateurs?
And you know what they say, this year, because I was just wanting to make sure and be on top of things, is really important for the magazine. Those awards are really important for the magazine. So I went out with a bunch of individual PR people and with a bunch of restaurateurs who I'm comfortable with. Went and had a beer and said, listen, tell me what's wrong and what's right. What do we get wrong? And one of the things I got from a lot of people was like, what are the criteria? Like, how are we trying to do it? But a big chunk of people, we just don't care. Like one prominent PR person said, my clients don't care. They've given up. It's not that they wouldn't like to win it. It's just that they can't figure out how to do it. So they're not going to waste any time trying. And I had another person who says it's worth easily six figures for a restaurant if they win gold in their category a year.
Oh, wow.
Which I was blown away. I don't know if that was hyperbole or not. I was like, that's unbelievable. I can't believe it. So I totally understand. The fact is, you're at the whims of the judges. They change every year. Not the actual judges, but the same judges in Italian one year won't be the same judges as Italian the next, because otherwise you would just get the same restaurants over and over again. And people know who the judges are. I mean, they're published. You can see it. It's not, no one's.
Do you guys have criteria for them? Do you say like you have to go to the restaurant a certain amount of times or like?
Not really. I mean, broadly, I mean, we don't really have problems with that. There's just a real weeding out of that sort of lollygagging. So no, there's no hard criteria. And you know, it costs the judges money. Like we pay them, but we don't pay them enough. Like if you're a judge in the upscale pod, you got to go to Bauhaus, Le Croc, Hawksworth, Boulevard.
It's going to cost you some money.
Yeah, man, it's going to cost you, like the stipend does not cover that. If you're in the pizza category, you could probably do it, right? But there's certain categories that it really is going to. So they give a lot.
Yeah. Who picks the judges?
Me.
You do? You just randomly pick new ones every year, or do you kind of?
I talk to people, but yeah, it's me.
That's exciting.
It's pretty much, it doesn't change that much. We added a bunch this year.
Yeah.
Just because I wanted to add a bunch. I added a couple this year who aren't industry people at all. One, I mean, they're not secret. One, Sven Freiby runs, you know, Freiby Meats, eats out all the time, has people coming in from out of town all the time. So is a true non-industry person at a restaurant. So if he's at Hawksworth and it's amazing, it's because the average person walking in Hawksworth, I mean, average, it's an expensive restaurant, but the average person walking in gets a great deal. And I'm really comfortable that he brings a perspective of, you know, the normal sort of patron of that.
Do you give them kind of like, okay, this is what we hope for you to give us back, kind of like feedback, kind of like, okay, when you go to the restaurant, you know, we want you to look for certain things, or do you just want them to be like, just give us your overall impression?
So what happens is that everyone's put into pods. All the judges vote on the big ones, best new restaurant of the year, chef of the year. But other than that, they're on pods. So there may be seven judges in Italian. They're on a Slack channel and they debate it like crazy people back and forth. So that all comes out. There's no criteria to check off. There's a 19-page Slack channel. You scroll down it.
That's where you guys should print.
Yeah. Just print
don't even print the awards.
Live feed, this live stream, the Slack.
Totally. Channel.
Don't print the awards. Just print that shit.
Yeah.
I'd read that.
And you know, people drop down in those Slack channels a lot. Sometimes, yeah, some people find it too much. When I was a judge, you know, before I ran it, I was a judge. I used to love mixing it up on those. That was one of my favorite parts, is like getting into it over whatever, best friend or so forth. That's the fun part.
Do you ever pick a corner and you're like, fuck, no, you guys are wrong. This is the best restaurant. And like,
oh,
this.
Yeah, sure.
And
sure.
You like just try to put your foot down and you're like,
I mean, no. I don't. There's nothing I can do. Like I don't think La Quercia was in the top five 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And I got a lot of respect for that.
There's a lot of Italian restaurants. Like that's a hard category to win.
A tough category.
That's a big one. I'm like,
that's a tough
my
category.
God.
Like, maybe the toughest category.
I think it's the toughest one.
When you look at the top five, when you look at the good restaurants that don't make it to the top five, like really good, really successful, really consistent restaurants. Yeah, that's a brutal.
It's like, oh, okay. So we got Savio, we got Pepino's, we got Astro Luigi, we got Chupino's, we got, you know, Chin Chin. We got like, it's like, holy fuck, there's some good restaurants. Autostrada. Yeah. It's like, okay, so what do we, who, what's, what? Well, who's better than what? And what's different? And like, you know, it's like, okay, so Savio's got the nicest room and it's beautiful. And Paul Grunberg and fucking crazy busy every damn day. Yeah. But then how's that different from, you know, like, is the food better at Chipino's? You know,
so yeah, we don't do 40% for this, 20% for this. And maybe we could, but you're right. Like the plate of food at Chipino's is one thing. The whole experience at Chipino's is another. The cost, those are all factors. And we just generally expect the judges through discussing with them, and there's no lightweights in the judging panel. They're really, really top notch. And then they balance that with definitely like being at Savio and just feeling like you're in the center of the world. The room's loud, and it could be Tuesday, like 9:30, the room's buzzing. Like it's so you just have to figure out on any given day, what would you tell, you know, your aunt and uncle who are driving in from Langley to celebrate their 25th anniversary? Where should you go for the best dinner? Right. That's I don't mind that as a criteria. I like that more than 20% for ambience, 30% for wine, 25% for food, like that. Yeah. Just, I hate filling things out like that. Because I'd like it to be conversational in the way and honest. That's why they're both conversations are honest. Like we're shooting the shit right now, but whatever. We'd rag on a few places and we'd rave about a few places, and we wouldn't break it down. We might argue about the wine less good enough, et cetera. And that's how I'd like the conversation with the judges to go. And at the end, they don't reach a conclusion at all, because all seven of them go off and in secret vote. So they don't even know. The judges don't even know who wins essentially till the award.
Oh, yeah. You're the man with all the power.
And as well, yeah. Talk about king of the dipshits, but yeah.
Seems fair.
How do you deal with the feedback of the VanMag Awards?
Well, you know, this year I went to Boulevard afterwards. There's a party afterwards, and Vikram was there, who I know a little bit, but not a lot. I wouldn't say
it was Vikram.
Vikram Vidge.
Vidge, yeah.
Vidges.
Vidges did not make it in the top five.
That's a great restaurant.
And I went up to him and it's like, I don't know what to say. I think it was wrong. I don't think it was in the top five this year. Definitely was in the top three. And I don't know. And then the winners were from the place in West Van. I can't remember. Don't even show up. Vikram's sitting there in the front row. So I feel like a horse's ass. And I just went up and sort of like drank a glass of champagne with them and said, you know,
do they care?
Go figure. Some do, some don't. Some don't care. I get cornered by a couple people. You know, I'll tell you who I did run into. I don't think this is telling tales out of school. I ran into Frankie and Sean immediately as I walked out. And I'm very fond of both those guys. Again, not friends, but really quite fond of that place. I didn't get to vote best new. I mean, if you looked at my credit card statement of the place I've been to most in the last 12 months, Como would probably be up there. I don't live that close to it.
Mickey doesn't go.
Who won best new?
Stem in Burnaby. Also a cool restaurant. People like the idea of it.
Because it's Stem Japanese, right?
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah.
And it's
and
it's
you don't awesome. You don't even go out, and you love Como. You go all the time.
Yeah, I very rarely go out.
Yeah.
Well, I also eat a vegan diet, so I'm a bit limited.
But you love Como.
I love it just because it's so different.
Oh, it's great.
Like,
I love it.
Everything is simple, but done really, really well. Right.
Mm. And you know, the fact is, like, if you want to take the piss out of Como, you could. There's a bunch of things. Like that hamburguesa is $12 and it's like a tiny little hamburger.
That's the one thing I will say is that the one negative comment people always have is it's too expensive for the portion sizes.
Somebody said
I don't think so.
I don't think that has anything to do with that. I just think people just don't understand tapas.
I agree. Yeah. I like the value.
I think it has nothing to do with them.
Yeah.
I think just people just sometimes struggle with the idea of tapas. And
when I was talking with a rest, when I was doing my interviews with how can we fix it? I won't say who it was, but a well-known restaurateur was saying it's great. But he called it being comatized. And you go there and you're having fun, da 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 da, and I'll have one more of those, and I'll just have one more share.
Yeah.
And the bill comes, you're like, holy shit, that was expensive. But I keep going back. So clearly, for me, it fits in the right norm, because I just love the vibe of it. I like the food. It's casual. They hit all the notes properly. And they've had people like Shiva Reddy, who is doing the wine, when she's gone to, I think she's great. She's gone to Savio, but it hasn't dropped a beat without her. Like, it really is a good team there. Like, that's a place I would probably, Nico
runs it.
Yeah.
Does Mark still,
also
I think,
seems a
I
good
think Mark
guy.
McNeil, Mark still works there, right?
Yeah.
I think he still works there as well.
Yeah, so I ran into them immediately thereafter, and I think their hope would be that they would have won Best New. It's a pretty buzzy new room, and they were, I don't know, fourth or fifth. I can't remember. They went in the top three. And so I was just like, yeah, it is what it is. Like, they know the process. They know I can't do anything about it. I think they broadly, for most things, have respect for at least a chunk of the judges, and it is what it is. But I'd be lying if I wasn't pulling for them to win En Route's Best New.
Yeah, that's coming out this week, right?
Yeah, that comes out, I think that's in the next couple of weeks. 100% pulling for them to win that, regardless. I don't think it makes us look bad, but I realize the choices our judges made for best new, and it is what it is, but I do like that place. So that was awkward bumping into them. I mean, awkward. They didn't make it awkward. I felt bad. They were super cool about it.
You don't seem awkward at all.
No.
Very, very.
I guess that's what comes with being in the situation, the role that you're in. Sure. So you're just going to feel that guilt sometimes.
Sure, absolutely. And I feel like we get it wrong. But again, nothing I can do. Like, that was, I mean, I think that was initially put in place so people think, people wouldn't have the thought that our advertisers, we don't have very many food advertisers, it's not the bread and butter, but Cactus is probably still an advertiser most times or so forth. Earl's probably does. Some of the bigger things will advertise on occasion. So there's no thought that we would favor behind the scenes people who support the magazine. So I do appreciate that's a pain in the ass to have the accountants involved and there's an expense to it and so forth. But I do think it was whoever made the decision, whether or not it was John or Gary, was a super wise decision to make, because it makes it easy just to throw up your hands and say, nothing we can do.
Huh. Interesting. Do you like where the Vancouver's market is right now?
In food, it's just so tricky to, I mean, we are just talking about that now. Who would open a bar or restaurant right now? You gotta have button for punishment. The food costs are so high. The minimum wage is going up, and it should
go up.
It should, but customers are like, I've gone through, I think, a growth of being more accepting to higher prices, but customers still want the lowest. Like, we're a mature restaurant market. We're not a mature consumer market. We want the cheapest thing right off the bat. And I, you know, like Papina, you know, Angus,
yeah,
they're
on Granville Island.
Yeah, down on Granville Island. That looked like it was a slam dunk, and I think they're doing all right. But a lot of people have been complaining, geez, that place is expensive. Counter service doesn't look like it has a lot of infrastructure. But I don't, those are seasoned restaurateurs. They're buying very good ingredients. They're not willing to cave on that and buy garbage and sell it for $1.50 less. So the fact is the burgers and the fried chicken are a little bit more expensive. The seafood platters are expensive because good fresh seafood's expensive, and they make a modest markup so they can make a living, et cetera, et cetera. And I still think that's a place that people, locals, I don't think visitors to Granville Island think it's a great deal, especially if they have American dollars, are having a tough time with the prices. But that is what it is. Those prices for good ingredients, paying a living wage, paying proper things, is what it is. And so we're not mature in terms of consumers. We don't accept that there should be benefits for people who work at a restaurant. And you shouldn't be having an owner who has to only give you two shifts a week so you're never full-time and all those sorts of things. Like, if they're run properly, they should cost more than they do, and consumers have to accept that. And I just don't think consumers are ready to do that.
Well, I mean, that's what my new column's coming out. Basically based on that idea. It's just people's perceptions of what prices are lag time. The lag time's just too slow. It's
so
just
how does that start to shift, or
how do you get people to catch up?
Everybody's got a collusion. Restaurant owners. Everyone raises their prices.
Yeah, that's what James was talking about.
The way you get people to catch up, there's a couple of things, I think, in my opinion, is like one, unfortunately this sounds really bad, but we need some restaurants to close. There's just too many.
Yeah.
There's just way too many in the city. There's way too many restaurants in the city. And I mean, the reason why pricing is the way it is just so much competition. You have a dilution of so much competition, and there's always going to be one guy out there who's just going to try to undercut someone else.
Yeah.
And then they fuck it for everyone else.
Yeah.
And it's usually, sometimes it can also be the bigger players. I mean, you go to Earl's, their happy hour is ridiculous.
Yeah, the cocktail's $3.50.
Yeah, it's so cheap.
But if you go in there, it's not. But it's expensive.
But if you're a regular restaurant, small restaurateur, how the fuck do you compete with that?
Yeah.
You know, like, how do you compete with a Donnelly group who has massive buying power and just open up? And we talked about this in the last episode. I really like Ballyhoo. I really like Sing Sing.
Yeah.
But I mean, their buying power is so much bigger, and they can get away with bigger.
They can pass it on. And they pass it on to the consumer. It's a tough one, right?
And like, you look at places look at the places in the city right now that are really starting to dominate. I mean, you look at the Colony group. I mean, but look at it. It's a fucking pub. But look how fucking busy it is. People and
Instagram moments. What is it's that? Got a lot of great Instagram moments.
Yes, but what does that mean? That all it's telling you is people have no money.
Yeah.
But do they? I mean, I don't know. So what about, I don't know if they don't have the money. I just think they need to reallocate it. You're going out for dinner. Listen, it's ages ago, but when you're a broke student, that's no money. Like, now people spend a lot of jack. Mm-hmm. So don't go and get the black truffle shaved on top of your pasta at Trattoria. and then tell me you're broke or you want something cheaper. Like, I do think it's, I know that sounds like, I still, by the way, I still don't think you can mark your wine up three times.
No.
Like there's I have limits, but I do think that a hamburger, it should be, I can pay 14 or 15 bucks for it if it has meat from Two Rivers or something or other. It costs money. It costs a lot more money than the garbage stuff.
Yeah. Well, we had a guy come to my bar at the airport the other day, and we have one of those new fancy, what are those wine? They keep the wine.
Unimatic.
Unimatic, yeah. It keeps temperature controlled and keeps it fresh for at least a month and a half.
Yeah.
And he's excited that we had one at the airport. So he's like, oh, I'll just go down the list. So we have four wines in there.
Yeah.
And we sell a glass of Oculus for $54 a glass.
Sure. Sweet Oculus.
So the markup thing in the hotel world is sure, but Oculus, insane.
$150 a bottle now. Like Oculus has crept up at retail. It's $150 a bottle for that wine.
Oh, so that's not that big of a markup?
Well, it's not terrible.
Okay.
Yeah, by the way, that's six. You have no, that's actually not even. So let's, if you get five pours from a bottle.
Should be five, yeah.
Yeah, but that's not a bad, that's not the worst markup. It's $150 bottle of wine. Better. So that's $250 markup on the bottle. That's, we should go have some of that.
Come
right
to the
now.
Airport,
save
come
some
see
money.
Me.
Save some money on the old Oculus. That's not terrible. It does seem like a lot of money though, $54. But that being said, Oculus is just the flagship wine. Rightly or wrongly, it's the flagship wine of the Okanagan right now.
Do you feel a pressure to, when you, as the food editor of VanMag, to really try to go out there and source out a lot of the smaller guys?
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah. Sure.
Like kind of like not like be like, oh, I'm not just always going to, you know, support. Like, do you ever feel a pressure? Like I got to make sure that the city is being well represented.
Yeah, sure. And I try and source out writing a review right now. Someone who doesn't have any PR.
Something like ugly dumpling.
Like I mean, the ugly dumpling, it doesn't really count. It is a small guy, but it's slam because it's got all the industry connections on our side as well. So it's doing quite well. And it's a small room. So it doesn't need any love. It doesn't have, and it does have a little bit of PR. I mean, it is a small independent restaurant and I'm fully supportive of it, but it doesn't need help. But there are other places. I have one, a friend opened a restaurant and I haven't done anything on it because I feel like there's a conflict called Sprezzatura on Kingsway between Savio and Como. It's a super nice room. It's a big room. He was running restaurants in London. I haven't done anything on it because he's a friend. Which seems weird, but I can't review it and be honest about it. But I've been telling people to go and asking other writers to go on their own and sort of try it out. And so I do, someone who's trying to make it on their own, who doesn't know the ins and outs and doesn't have the money for PR, I definitely would try and seek them out. And I would definitely try and not go to the places that everyone's fawning about.
Yeah.
Dachi, right? I don't need to go there. That's out there. People have been there. It's beloved already. I wouldn't normally go and review that. I'd go and try it. An ugly dumpling I might put in that category a little bit. I feel like it's sort of done a good job of establishing itself as sort of a go-to spot in quality. But there's so many others of people who are opening spots that they don't know how it works. They don't know how our side of it works. And I mean that in sort of the dirty dealing side of it, that you need to get PR to get your name out there. And if you don't, you get frozen out in some ways, not by the PR people. It just, the status is so much PR, press release, invited for a media dinner, repeat to churn the news out, that it's really difficult if you're not part of that system, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult to get in that system. Just on skill alone. So I would feel strong. I mean, the problem is in today's day, I just don't feel like it makes that much difference with VanMag's reach. It doesn't, we can't, it would be great.
You know, 15 years ago, a great review might make or break a restaurant or might do something.
Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody has that power anymore, to be honest. I really don't think anybody has that power anymore. Like there was, I think even when Alex, you know, the Globe's a big platform. Even when she really slams a place, I'm sure they go down a little bit, but I don't think it. She gave a terrible review back in the day to Nightingale, and boy, they're still struggling, hey? Like, I mean, it just doesn't. I just don't think that the age of that massive power is gone.
Well, I wrote about that.
Point.
I wrote about that 2 years ago. I think that the days of the food writer are their days are numbered.
Food critic. The food critic is numbered
because you just. I mean, one of the main reasons why the food critic, I think, is just dying is because 30 years ago, restaurants didn't have websites.
Yeah, yeah.
Now they have websites and they have Instagram. Yeah. You don't really need a food critic anymore. Yeah. You can see it for your own two eyes what you're going to be getting.
I have not gone out for dinner, maybe a couple times, but the exception I have not. If I go for dinner, even Vancouver or any city, if I'm traveling, I'm on the website before. If they have a menu that doesn't have prices or their wine list doesn't have prices, I look at that every time before every restaurant I go to. And if I get a bad vibe, I won't go to it. If I get things on the, if the dishes are such that they're dated or they look like they're done by someone who's looking for Instagram-y sort of things, I won't go. And if the wine list has insane markups, but for some other reason, I won't go. And you're right. I have that power as the consumer. I just click on whatever their name is, and you have all these, this wealth of information right off the bat.
Yeah, and you get all these reviews. It's all there. It's so easy. Do you, totally tangent off here, but would you consider yourself a wino or a whiskey?
Wine.
You're a wino? I feel like you're a wino.
Yeah. I used to think, I play the game, what could I do without wine, beer, or liquor? And it changes because for a long period of time, it really only stopped in the last year. I couldn't imagine not having a beer. I'd probably have a beer every single day at the end of the day. And that ritual was just bam. I just loved it. But beer has probably fallen to third now. I've overdosed a little bit on the craft beer. I was an IPA guy for the most part, bitters and IPAs. And I just hit them so hard for so long that now I find I don't have the craving that I used to. And the other problem is if I start with a beer, when I pour myself a glass of wine, I don't really feel like I've had a drink already. The beer was just like a sort of palate cleanser. And then so I have two glasses of wine, and on Tuesday, if I want to have a whiskey at the end, now I'm four drinks into a Tuesday night, and that's not particularly good for hanging out at home watching Handmaid's Tale.
Because we've never done that.
So, I would say wine, if I had to give up one, wine would be the hardest. Probably then beer, then spirits. I mean, the fact is I just don't drink spirits that much anymore. And cocktails have really fallen off quite a bit for me. I'll drink whiskey. I'll drink mezcal. It's neat. Brandy, I'll still love to drink neat.
So I wrote that column on Scout. Yeah. Has cocktail culture peaked? And I just feel like cocktails are still big with people, but people are okay with going like, you know what? I want to go back to beer a little bit.
I want to talk about that column because I also find that interesting because I read it and I read the title and I initially thought, oh yeah, the answer is yes. And I do think there's a bit of that that is true. Like I want to separate the truth from the nostalgia because I don't want to be the old guy talking about how great Joe DiMaggio was or talking about how great Larry Bird and Magic were, or even Jordan, and they refuse to admit the current prop. They can't grasp how good basketball is.
Now you're talking
our
language here.
Yeah,
they can't grasp it. They just say Bird, Jordan, Dr. J, and I appreciate those were an amazing. That was an amazing time.
But there's nostalgia attached to it.
It's nostalgia attached to it. Yeah. And when I read yours, I was concerned because I think about 10 years ago. I do think our position in the worldwide pecking order of bars and bartenders was higher 10 years ago. We had, if you look at some of the, Sean being the youngest, but Mark Brand, David Wallowidnick, Josh.
Jay Jones.
Jay Jones.
Trevor Kelly.
Yeah, I mean, we had Lauren Moat, Danny. We had an insane cadre of.
Keenan.
Yeah, yeah. Jez.
Yeah.
We had, also around the CPBA, we had a cadre of unbelievably heavy-hitting bartenders worldwide. But I don't know if they're not the Larry Bird. And like, everyone's good now. Like, bartenders, the bar is so high now. And back then, we had an early start. This was a great cocktail city because we had a start on everyone. Like, there was no one, you know, who's your guy at the, who just won at the Fairmont?
Oh, Jeff Savage.
From Edmonton, right?
Yep.
There's no one in Edmonton back then when we had those people who was in the ballpark. There was maybe one or no one in Calgary.
Yeah.
No one until you hit Toronto. And even then, we could have put our lineup against anyone. And now the fact is, this amazing bartenders in Red Deer, probably.
Yeah. Right?
They're people, they have the ability to learn. They treat it far more seriously. And there's just so, we've lost that competitive advantage, but the overall talent is probably higher.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's kind of what I thought about. I was just like, I was thinking about this because I've obviously been doing it for so long, and I just feel like, yeah, I mean, I agree with you on the sentiment that we definitely had a peak 10 years ago. We're like, holy shit, we got some good talent here. And now you're right. Now it's just, now everyone's Mickey.
So Jeff is now like, Jeff is like Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Yeah.
And Sean is like,
Sean's a bridge.
Sean's
right?
Like, he's the Paul youngest George. Of that group. No, yeah. I think I'd go younger than that.
Yeah. No, yeah. He like Sean Layton, you mean?
No, Sean, Sean McGuigan.
McGuigan.
Tough name to say.
Yeah, he'd be like, Paul George.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
He'd be Sean and Chris would Ends. Be like a Grant Hill.
Yeah.
Hey, well, okay. Light, you could take them home. Totally. Good.
Green cut.
Do you play basketball?
No, no, not anymore. I'm 1,000 years
you?
Old.
Tall enough
I
to.
Did back in the day. Yeah, I was terrible at it. So, but do you still drink? I don't go out and order cocktails anymore. Like I've become quite, I drink martinis, like martinis, not
right.
Like a martini, gin? It's a gin. Yeah. Gin that's martini? Like, not a, and I'm hard on that. Like if something has a type of martini, like I'm drinking a martini, like I drank, I don't know if phrase this right. I drank quite a bit when I was young
mm-hmm.
and I went hard out of the gate. Like I never had a cooler phase and so forth. I learned how to drink whiskey and martinis really young. And they're not naturally appealing to a vibrant young palate. They're not, but I earned the ability to drink a cold 3-ounce gin martini, such to the point that I loved it. So I'm really protective of that name. That so I don't like that being watered down. I mean, I guess vodka is sort of okay. I don't really care for vodka martinis.
No lemon drops for you.
No,
no cosmos.
Well, to me, a martini is a gin. Gin. It's always gin.
Yeah. It has
like,
to be.
When absolutely. People are like, I want a vodka martini, I'm like, it's not a martini.
It should have a different name. It doesn't have to be.
You want
less.
Chilled
it
vodka.
Fucking James Bond, huh?
Yeah, I know.
You're for yeah.
But I don't find I order bespoke cocktails much. Like a creation of the bartender. And I think 10 years ago I would have done that more. Now because I drink less, I like what I like. I have a few go to orders. And the problem is it's not that I don't love, I almost always love back to how high the quality is. If you pick a whatever on somebody's list and order it and it has some of the spirits you like, it's always really good. Like it's so rare to have a bad drink in this town. Like it just doesn't happen much.
Mm.
But that being said, I don't want to be delighted and surprised all the time. Sometimes I just want the old friend to take the edge off.
Yeah.
Mickey's not drinking beer right now.
I'm off beer now, yeah. I'm doing this reason? Whole gluten thing now.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And you're not going to have Glutenberg or any of the gluten-free beers?
Well, I didn't realize it, but my main source of protein was these vegan hot dogs.
Oh, yeah,
the
sure.
Very first ingredient is gluten. The second ingredient is expressed safflower oil because they're binders.
Yeah.
And it's been about a month sample size, and I've dropped so much weight, and I feel super light, and I feel really good. So I'm kind of rediscovering my love of red wine.
Did you stop the... wouldn't you take the vegan hot dogs out first and keep drinking beer? You've taken both of them out.
I decided to do
that was the logical question.
Yeah, I went Band-Aid style. Just like all of it. So pasta, bread, that kind of stuff. So
but ladies.
I'm one of those people now.
Yeah, yeah.
Ladies, Mickey's six-pack is almost here.
It's coming.
Yeah, so,
it's getting there. So
if you're back and counting and growing.
If you have some laundry, you want to be done.
It's sad for me because I'm a huge craft beer fan, but I think wine for me just to... piggyback on your point has the more I kind of got to a saturation point with craft beer. It's like, okay, I've had everything there is to have in Vancouver, but wine for me is this like sort of undiscovered territory
so much
that I used to like when I was younger, and I have friends that are sommeliers, so I'm really getting back into it.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, and it starts the night. I love it. I went to there was a Writers Fest event called a whiskey event, I don't know, 6 months ago, and a friend of mine won one of the silent auction items, and it was a whiskey pairing dinner at Boulevard with Highland Park. So 8 people of us go there. And my initial thought was, hey, Boulevard, especially on a special occasion, is like insanely good.
I was there last night.
Yeah. And how was it?
Great.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always worried about, I used to say always worry. I worried about that in the early days when it was winning at Van Mag, that it was a place that if they knew who you were and so forth, it was great. And if it wasn't, it was just okay. They're bad.
Yeah.
I've had a couple meals there, not media meals, once with one of the judges as a date, and then again this one, and then another one was when the Michelin starred thing, so I was there as a guest, but they were off the charts.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Anyways, this was a scotch pairing with food, and I always hate that. I got to be honest. I want to drink my whiskey neat. I don't want to pair it. Wine has been pairing with food for millennia. It's perfect. I don't even like beer pairing with food. I just like it simple. But this one did surprise me. It was really, really good. But that being said, really, really good gets you to the level of just basic wine pairing. Like knocking it out of the park with whiskey pairing with food is just, and it, that's how I want to drink as well. I want to drink while I'm eating and while I'm cooking.
Yeah.
So for me, it's that. But white wine has, my wife can't believe it, but white wine is.
That's my thing.
It's more common. I used to drink red wine all the time. I still drink it a ton. But I will, especially early in the night, I'll drink it. And, you know, when you're with wine writers, they drink a lot more white wine than red for the most part.
Really?
Yeah. Just because they like high acid wines a lot. They like wines that pair with food. They don't like an overabundance of fruit. I mean, this is a generalization. There are some who are different. But when I think of our old Van Meg Wine Awards judges, who I see all the time, they're often, they all go nuts for champagne. And bubbles because of really high acid point. But other than that, they like high acid.
Yeah, I'm straight Loire Valley. Loire Valley is great. That's my go-to.
Yeah.
Loire. Everything about the Loire. I love the Loire Valley. You just get great acid, great wines, reds, whites, bubbles.
Not expensive.
Not super expensive. Super underappreciated. And, you know, I always tell people, I'm like, you can find an amazing Loire wine that will rival pretty much anything from any other region in the world. And I think it's so special where the wines that come from there because they just get all that great acid.
What about Columbia Valley? Have anything from there?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So I'm on a couple lists, one of which is Quilceta Creek, which may be the best. And if you care about points, Quilceta Creek is the best awarded red wine, I think, in the world. Definitely in the United States. So that is, it's expensive, but it is Columbia Valley Cabernet Sauvignon. It is the greatest red wine to come out of Washington. Some people might say Cayuse Syrah is, but it is generally regarded, if a points person, Parker and Wine Spectator, it routinely gets 100 points. So I love that one because that's a sledgehammer of but really strong tan, and so not a fruit bomb, a ton of fruit and boozy, sometimes like 15%. But it is unbelievable.
That valley's so hot, right?
Oh, it's so hot and ugly.
Yeah, I've been there.
You know, it's one of the worst looking wine regions. Oh, the Columbia Valley is ugly.
It's weird. It's just like it's like rolly. It's like hot, and you just. They grow a lot of hops there too, right? So it's like,
Yeah, but I love Washington wines. Washington whites, not quite as much. They make some decent Riesling, but Washington reds,
Washington
Syrahs. Washington Syrahs. What
do you ask that? We have a lot now. So our wine program is now, shout out to Steve if you're listening. He's in charge of it. He does all BC, Washington, Oregon, and California.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of stuff, not only from Willamette, but from Columbia Valley as well. And we've just been trying some Bordeaux blends from there and some Pinot Noirs, and they're all like really, really good.
So the Aquilini and Aquilini family.
Yes, I know of them.
Owners. Yeah. We know who they are.
They just bought a huge swath of land, like almost the best land, or some of the best land on Red Mountain.
Really?
In Washington. And so I've tried their wine at Eliza. I think it's Eliza. I can't remember. I don't know how to pronounce
that.
I think it's Eliza. Let's say Eliza, their steakhouse. It's because it's one of the better prices. Expensive wine list there. You expect that for a steakhouse. But it's one of the better priced wines on their list, and it's actually quite good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's quite good. Good big red fruit. That's what you expect from Washington. That's what I expect from Washington.
Hmm. We should go for steak dinner, Mickey. You can watch me eat it.
Yeah, we will. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'll drink while you eat.
Do you ever go to the Acorn?
No.
No?
No.
Do you like vegetarian food?
No.
No?
I mean, I don't not go to the Acorn. It's just the lineup. Like, I've been there before, and it's great. I like it. They were upset at a review that John Burns, who was our old editor who wrote, who's been a vegetarian for, I don't know, for as long as I know him, 20 years. A really smart guy, really, really great writer, really, I trust his palate on such things. And he travels a lot, so he finds the vegetarian places throughout the world. So he had a really good, take on it. And he did the review of the Arbor, I think, when it opened, and it wasn't super, it wasn't super flattering, and we heard about that.
No, it's just interesting. I know,
that's not why I don't go to the Acorn. The Acorn is just I don't like lining up for it. I would not go to it.
No reservations.
I know. I'm just saying. I think about that sometimes because I talk to people like when I recommend restaurants at the hotel. I'm like, you should check out this place. And they're like, what is it? I'm like, oh, it's vegetarian. They're like, ugh. I'm like, what do you mean, ugh? It's really good. But vegetarian still has this kind of weird scoff thing. You know,
it is a weird thing. It is. Yeah.
People just can't get over it.
I guess people don't like is a limit.
So
but you're right.
How dare you tell me that I can't have
a Thai restaurant has a limit, You're not going to get a ribeye. I mean, there's a lot. It's almost weird. Every restaurant other than Cactus doesn't have a limit, but most restaurants have some limit. But for some reason, the meat one
puts
people out.
I don't get it. It's such a weird thing.
You feel better.
Yeah.
I always do feel better when I eat vegetarian.
Yeah.
There's a restaurant called Ubuntu in Napa back in the day, not to be confused with the one that's on Fraser right now. that was at the time, the sort of great vegetarian restaurant. I went with my wife and kids, and we were all blown away. We're all ready to become vegetarians. And we went back to the harsh reality of the Nom.
we were just talking about the Nom on the last episode and the quality there.
Fuck, you went off on that one.
There's a broad spectrum in the city
that
are exposed to, but.
Yeah.
Should I throw them some questions here?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. If you could stage as a sommelier for 1 week in a Vancouver restaurant, which one would it be?
Oh.
I knew that'd be a good question.
Savio.
Ooh.
Savio, I think, because, I mean, do I have to use their list or can I bring my own?
You have to use their list. Huh. I wonder what would you put on your list if you had your own list?
A lot of Italian. A lot of Italian. Cool, some cool kids, Okanagans, things that people don't know about.
Yeah.
A lot of Washington, very little California, maybe some hipster California. It's so expensive to get the cool California. Oregon, France, I love the Loire with you. Like Reds from the Loire, Le Chenons, the Cabernet Francs are fresh and light and
Sancerre
good.
Rouge, delicious.
Yeah, yeah, expensive, but great wine. So I don't know why I blurted out Savio.
That's a good choice, not a bad choice. I think it's
great. You know what? I'm going to say, let's say Hawksworth. It's got such a deep list.
That's what I would do.
And there's some back bottles there that could be super cool and some sort of off vintage Bordeaux that are drinking well right now. So I'm going to say,
And look at that Somme team too. Yeesh.
Yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable. Fuck. It's crazy. It's like, that's like the murderer's row Yankees. Like all those other people are like you're the second Somme and you're like an insanely talented Somme.
Do you have your W set? No,
I'm too old. Like there wasn't a thing when I was young. So I could go back to school. Like, Rodney Dangerfield for like laughs, but
what is your favorite type of cuisine to eat?
Italian.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you have a favorite BC winery?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I write about wine a lot, so I'm gonna talk about a couple.
Mine's Sincromesh right now.
Yeah, people love the Sincromesh. I love the Riesling. I'm gonna talk about a couple because I don't want to say it for different reasons. Tantalus makes no bad wine at all. Like even the Chardonnay, you stomach on it. It's insanely good.
I had their bubbles the other night. Fucking delicious.
Amazing.
$30. Yeah. Fucking great.
And we're going to go. So that's north. I'll go south. Moon Cursor and a Soyuz. They're the coolest. What they push the envelope. Touriga Nacional are nice. Dolcetto. I mean, they're just awesome people. Tempranillo. Mm-hmm. They are trying things. They're making things insanely shine. And Blue Mountain. One of the great wineries. They don't toot their own horn at all. It's insanely good. They're just coming out with these single vineyard Pinots. I haven't tried them yet, but it's been underpriced. Their wine has been underpriced for 20 years. Mm. So those are three just off the top of my head. I'm going to forget Terra Vista. I love with the whites. I think they're doing a great job. And I'm sure a ton of
them. Do you get out there often?
Couple times a year, not as much. Like I should be up there all the time because I have to deal with all that for Western Living. So not as much. I love it up there. When I'm up there, I'm just in a happy place.
Nice. Kruger Dom.
Ooh.
That's a really tricky one. So I'm going to tell, can I tell a Here's the Me story? After saying judicial, I want to talk about journalistic independence. I went to Champagne with LVMH a couple of years ago and drank 13 bottles of Krug in one day.
Excuse me?
13 different bottles of Krug in one day. God. It was insane. And there's an app you can get. It's so cool. It's such a baller app. I took it off because it's taking too much space, called the Krug app. And you can scan every capsule and get, anyways. Here's the thing. Deep, deep down, if I'm being honest, it's cooler to say Krug. And because Dom is so, Dom, and everyone says all the time, I like Dom better. I don't love the heaviness of Krug. I love the balance of Dom a little bit more. And sometimes I'll like a Blanc de Blanc champagne a lot, like a Tattnager. So although I know Krug is the right answer, and that was such a special day to drink all that Krug, and I would pull my teeth out to get it before, deep down inside, if I'm not thinking what people judge, I like Dom better.
Wow. Interesting.
This is, by the way, these are theoretical questions for... 99.
Yeah, because the Dom right now, the Dom that's out right now is the 2009, but I think they just released the 2008s as well. The 8s have been coming out. Krug, the Grand Cuvée, I think they disgorged it 3 years ago. What's out right now? But it's I'm Krug.
I'm going to put a little proviso on that. I assume you're talking about the non-vintage Krug.
Yeah,
the Grand Cuvée. This is the vintage Dom. If I could have vintage Krug, or if I could have, I think their Chardonnay is Claude Le Meny.
Yeah, Claude Mesnil.
Mesnil. And that's $1,200 a bottle. So I'm going for that. But that's if just.
So base for base.
At the top here, we got a little bit, a snippet of his feelings on the BC liquor industry.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that? Is there anything that you would change? Have you ever met Blaine?
No.
No?
No. I know Barb Phillip.
Barb Phillip, yeah.
Yeah. I have a lot of time for her.
My old instructor.
A lot of time for her. What do I think about it? I mean, you know, I had a friend back in the day when I used to practice law who was worked as a consultant for Ernst & Young, I think, maybe PricewaterhouseCoopers. And he came out, this is a story he told. I don't know if this is true. He came out to privatize the liquor industry here. He was going to be the consultant because I was living in Alberta. I was in Alberta when privatization happened there, and it was the greatest thing ever. The first couple of years was like the Wild West. People didn't know what to price it. So they'd put a dollar markup on a bottle of Mondavi, like Woodbridge, and they put a dollar markup on a bottle of Krug. You could buy like champagne. You could buy vintage Veuve for like $31 a bottle all the time. It was totally insane. Scotch was, people from Edinburgh would buy Scotch in Calgary as opposed to buying it in Scotland. It was so cheap. So it was great, the Wild West. So he comes out, everything's good to go, and Gordon Campbell gets caught drinking and driving in Maui. And that's the death of our private liquor store. I mean, private is better. There's just no doubt that private is better. We're talking about the Costco liquor stores, even, and forget about going to the States. The ones in Edmonton and Calgary are like a dream. But within our terrible system, the people who work there do a pretty good job. I mean, I hate that there are trends that come and go and we just can't do it. Like, I wanted to make a stinger the other day. I love having a stinger after dinner. White creme de menthe doesn't exist.
Yep.
It's like it doesn't exist in this province. Like, it's like Poland in 1983. Nope, can't make that drink. Like,
yeah.
What would you mean? Like, that's not that obscure a drink.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't exist. Like, you can't bring in 375 of white creme de menthe. So there are things that drive me crazy, but within the BS of a monopoly, they do all right.
Okay. That's a good answer. Yeah. Well, I mean, like, I have my thoughts, and don't get me started. I just think the red tape, I just want to, I
agree. You crazy.
Private is, you know, definitely what you want, but.
When you go to 39th and Canby, I mean, I almost never buy stuff. Well, I'll be honest, I very rarely buy liquor from the liquor store. I buy it from wineries. I get it imported. I bring it back. But sometimes you'll go there and you will find amazing things that no one writes about. Like Anne Gros is a Burgundy Négociant who is a grower. She's insanely good. No one talks about it. She's quite niche. And if someone hadn't turned me on to her, I wouldn't know. But you can go into that little back room at 39th and Canby and there's a couple bottles and they're no big deal and they're relatively well priced. They don't make a good deal about celebrating that, and probably because they can't, because it's, you know, they're in the volume business, but they do some things better than you'd think.
What's the most enjoyable part of your job? What do you like about it?
Oh,
you've been doing it for 12 years.
Yeah. You know what the most enjoyable part is? Would be true. And this is the sad thing in some ways about it. When you and I met however many years ago, we were chatting about writing and you're excited about it. You know, back in the day, I used to have a lot bigger budget for freelancers. I write your reviews. I'm happy to write your reviews. But one of the reasons I write them is because A, it's tough to find someone to write them properly, but B, we just don't have a huge budget and we need money for other things. But one of the great joys, and this is in some ways is more on the West and living in the travel thing, is finding someone who's anxious to be a writer and sending them on a trip to the Galapagos or something, or just send them to review a restaurant when they've not done anything like that, or go to a wine tasting and talk about it and have them come back and write about it and get super jacked and excited about it. I love that. I love that. And that's tougher and tougher, A, because our budgets are smaller, and B, less and less people are more interested in writing. They know how the industry is going. And so they go into different pursuits. So people who had a desire to be writers are doing something different. So that, you know, that was a bigger part of my job 8 years ago than it is now. And that Sabbath, that's still one of my very favorite things. When you send a writer on a assignment somewhere and they love it and they come back with something great and they get excited and get into the industry. That is my favorite part of my job.
Amazing. I like that. Would you guys ever go into this medium, podcasting or video?
Our editors, Stacey McLaughlin, has a After Chef Junior. What is it? What's the Kids Chef one?
Kids Chef one?
Yeah,
Master Chef Junior.
Yeah, Master Chef Junior. She does it's called After Chef. That's why it's called Master Chef Junior. After Chef Junior. And her and someone who used to work at our magazine do a podcast on that.
Oh, really?
It's very successful. Like, I think it's for that. It's a niche, but I think she's going to Cincinnati in like sometime soon to like, because the podcast has got the attention of the show or our fans or something or other.
That's awesome.
So she's good. And she's a comedian on the side. So she's very funny. I mean, we should. You guys do a good job of it.
We're available.
When you guys retire. Like, I don't know what we'd do. Politics would be boring. Food
you actually do a good job. I don't think there's need for another one in Vancouver. Yeah. But yeah, I'm glad it's here, but we don't need to do it if you're going to
Well, it's kind of like the Wild Wild West.
Yeah, no, I guess there's no, the startup barriers are minimal.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you guys are doing video too, I think, on the site. I just watched the Hot Goss.
Yeah, yeah.
With hot sauce.
Those are from the, I mean, we were doing those things, but again, with less editors and so forth, there's just not quite enough time. I mean, if we had a full team, we'd have amazing, like you look at Bon Appetit and some of the video stuff they do.
It's are you still out in Burnaby? That's where your office was before.
Yes. Yeah, I'm not in the office so much. No. I work from home quite a bit more, but you still win production and so forth.
I remember you when I went up and visited you, you're like, ugh, I hate being out here.
Yeah, it was not the best. I mean, just because, you know, I live, our old office used to be right in South Granville. Like I legitimately had, and I would still drive, I'm so lazy, but I legitimately had like a 45 second commute.
Yeah.
So having a normal commute, like by most Vancouver standards, like I think I'm about 22 or 23 minutes.
Yeah,
that's like a sweet commute, but it doesn't feel like it.
Yeah.
Mine's 6 minutes.
Yeah.
What's yours?
I'm at the airport. So at 15? Night, 10.
Night 15? Is great. Bottleneck. You're going the wrong time.
You got to know bottleneck. If you go down past, like you get, don't mess around with Southwest Marine because that's like a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, yeah.
So you just got to go down a little bit closer to the water where all that sort of, all the industrial parks are and Care the tech Avenue, places. Yeah, and you just kind of like scoot up past the liquor store. You can usually get it. Yeah.
That's not a bad liquor store, by the way. When I used to live down
Super
here.
Super Value or Value Liquor or whatever. Yeah. Pretty good stuff there.
And the yard. I remember reading you talking about
I talk about the yard all the time.
You been to the yard before?
No.
Dude.
It's dicey bar.
Yes, yard, the Brighton and French Cafe. Yeah. Yard is...
It's so dicey.
It's terrible in there. It's terrible though.
It is like actual bar fly.
Yeah.
You know, people think the phrase bar fly is like, oh, cool, it's a bar fly. That's like a... sad grinder of a bar.
It's fight. A guilty pleasure of mine. Super cheap whiskey. Everything's super cheap. And they have actually a pretty decent bottle beer selection.
I see a lot of those at the Ivanhoe in my area, and I also see a lot of them at the
London Pub. Ivanhoe level, but it's it's a tier down.
It's a different.
It's
a working right. It's a working sadness bar. Like it's just take the pain away. Of drug addiction, but of like the mundane terribleness of my life.
Fuck, I hate my life.
Last time I was in there.
That's I think in Latin. They should, that would be a good bar name.
It's in the
Latin
air.
Translation of fuck, I hate my life. I
get a few of those at the bar.
Yeah.
Come in, I'm like, how's your day? They're just like, I just need a drink. I'm like, fuck. Yeah. I'm like, fair enough. You got any other questions for Neil?
No, I just want to be on the Hot Goss Hot Sauce show
if possible. Yeah.
I am a huge chili head.
Oh, you can do it. You can
handle
slam
the hottest. Okay. I can handle a million plus Scoville units.
Okay.
Mad Dog 357.
Yeah.
Scorpion Pepper, all that kind of stuff.
You can Carolina
Reaper.
Throw down.
Yeah.
You can eat that? Why?
It's just fun. The endorphin rush.
Ooh. Yeah. I do like it, but I'm a real sweater.
I can't do it.
So pull some strings and get me on that show.
Okay.
Neil, this is great. Thank you so much.
All right, guys. That's fun.
That was Neil McLennan. I hope you guys enjoyed the conversation we just had with him. Obviously, don't really need to introduce too much here. Western Living, Vancouver Magazine, you've probably read them. You probably still read them. Continue to check out his work there. Fan Mag Awards are always every year in April.
Yeah, late April, early.
Late April. Okay, so look for those. Those are obviously very big for them. Neil, this was great. Thank you so much. We'll definitely try to have you on again another time.
And, absolutely.
As always, you can find us on Luminary, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Do check out our website, midrangedvancouver.com. And we'll check you another day. Thank you so much.